Right, we're moving over now into our open forum. So you're welcome to ask general questions to the Brains Trust, or you can direct questions to individuals. So,
yes? Can I revert something that Howard said a bit earlier on, this thing, the jot and tittle, but that could be a sort of precise way of expressing a general truth, something like that. I mean, that's something that would be valuable to sort of pursue and clarify, because jot and tittle is a pretty precise thing, and even tied down to the Aramaic script, it doesn't apply to the archaic Greek Hebrew script.
Well, I was thinking of the fact that the tittle was, I believe, just a decoration on the letter. It therefore had no meaning to it, and whether the tittle was there or the tittle was not there, it didn't make any difference to the significance of what was being said. And just enlarging it, then saying, was it on the way to becoming the sort of proverbial expression it has become in English, meaning just no change in any matter whatever, and if so, has it to be taken with absolute literalness, or does it allow a little measure of freedom? That's what I was getting at.
It's translated jot and tittle as if it's a yod, a Hebrew yod, but of course it isn't. It's an iota. And I think the iota is referring to a yod, because that's sort of an I sound in Hebrew, and it's the smallest letter in the square script which was being used at that time. But I think the tittle, whatever it means something like a stroke of a pen. And in the square script, of course, you have just a little nick to distinguish between a beth, a b, and a kaf, the k. And the same sort of little nick between the dalet and the resh. And there are some places, like in Genesis 10, where you have the rhodamine or the dodamine. We don't know which is which, or we don't know which is correct, because it's just one little tittle which is probably been lost from the Masoretic text, because it says road. I get mixed up between the two now. Yeah, but I'm disagreeing with my learned friend here, who says it's just a phrase. I'm suggesting it's meant literally.
I see. Yes, because my point is do we have liberty to understand that? To be a bit free with that statement, because if we're so when you have all these variant manuscripts around, all of them, or many of them, with the truth in them, can we have a certain sort of freedom in interpreting that statement of Jesus?
I'm suggesting that the text that Jesus pointed to, which he didn't necessarily have in his hand, he would point to the standard text in Jerusalem. It is exactly one jot and not one tittle changed from what we have in the 9th century and in our Bibles now. So it's a success. It actually has happened literally. Whether Jesus meant it literally or not, I don't know, but it literally has happened.
Yeah, but that's the point. Did he mean it literally?
I still don't see how he can have meant it literally when he himself quoted from the Septuagint. So how could he say this is the version and then quote from another version? Would seem inconsistent if you really meant that.
I believe that the Hebrew and Greek texts, which we have pretty well accurately, are the inspired texts, but I hardly ever quote them on Sundays. I usually quote the NIV or the ESV or the Living Bible or whatever, because it means what I want it to mean for that Sunday. And Jesus did the same thing, but everyone knew the Hebrew.
Don't you mean it? You mean what it wanted to mean?
Isn't it a case that in some ways words that are in Greek or Hebrew, and then they might be standard, in some cases mean slightly different in the context, and so the translator tries to get the context to get the right shade of meaning for that word. Is that what?
Yeah, in Isaiah 6 it says that I will heal them, but the whole context of the passage is about repentance. Isaiah says he has unclean lips, and the coal comes and purifies his lips. And he says, I'm a man of sin. And so when it says about healing him, it's clearly talking about the removal of sins. So it's not, it's putting the emphasis of the whole passage into the one verse, but it's not an exact translation.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're translating the Old Testament,
what
do you use?
We normally use the UBS text.
What's that mean?
It's the text that the United Bible Society pushes in our direction for us to use.
But that's only the New Testament.
That's only New Testament, yes. I must admit, I've never worked on the Old Testament myself beyond working with Ruth. And so I honestly don't know. For Ruth, I don't have any Hebrew, so I cheated. I used the Traduction Économique Biblique, the TOEB from French.
I think the equivalent would be VHS for Hebrew.
Yes.
It's the great big... That's the standard Hebrew critical text. Biblica Hebraica Stuttgartensia, VHS. Yeah?
Yeah, it's completely different for New Testament and Old Testament. In the New Testament, we have a huge variety of different texts, about 7,000 variants in different manuscripts, but we have 5,000 manuscripts, and we know pretty well exactly what the original was. There's a few places where we're not sure, but they're minor, and there's a couple of major ones, but forget about them. So when we put together Greek texts, we have to put together an eclectic one. And the first person who did that was Erasmus, and he did a pretty good job. And we now have an even better job, the UBS text, which is exactly the same as the Nestle Island, except for a couple of places. But with the Hebrew text, we don't use an eclectic text. We use an exact copy of the Leningrad Codex from the 9th century. And the BHS is the Leningrad Codex, except for a few places where the printers got it wrong. Now what can you do? These scribes keep it right for 9 centuries and the printers make some mistakes.
But there is the further problem, or there are further two problems, which is that the BHS text, which gets printed, is the one which includes any errors that date from the beginning, whereas the UBS text of the New Testament is a reconstruction of what they think actually was written, as far as they can get that far back. And this makes it much easier to use the New Testament text because it makes sense than the Old Testament one, which sometimes is untranslatable.
Absolutely, absolutely.
The other point that should be mentioned is that the New Testament authors, when quoting the Old Testament, like Peter or anybody else or Paul, do not always agree with the Hebrew text and sometimes go with the Septuagint instead when it's different. So which text are we meant to go by in cases like that? There's a continuing problem for jots and tittles of that kind.
Possible that Jesus was referring to a deeper truth which did not depend upon minute textual details.
Too deep for me.
Well, yes, in a sense he is. He is concerned about the deeper meaning of the text, and he goes on to say, "You have heard what was said to them of old time, but I say to you," which involves some change of emphasis that you might call correction or going deeper or something of that kind. So he is certainly not sticking at the letter, literally, of it, but getting to the fuller understanding of it.
I think to some extent when you ask that question, you're starting to get into some fairly esoteric realms of linguistic philosophy. In there is a sense in which meaning cannot be translated or cannot be transmitted without language, and yet we also admit that language never quite gets what we see. It's on the tip of my tongue, I can't quite say what I mean. It sort of indicates that there are things that we'd like to express, but we find difficulties doing it. To say that's what Jesus was doing, however, I would struggle with. But then again, the whole issue of transmission of text, translation of texts, means that I'm very glad that folks like David do what they do, but I'm equally glad that I don't have to do it.
You keep to your budgets.
Yeah, it'd be a good swap.
Yeah, John. Isn't that a text that I've got about, you know, the prophecy relating to Judas that's quoted by Matthew? There's actually no way that the Zechariah prophecy can be translated the way Matthew does. Is there any text in Qumran or anything that could be translated in Matthew translated? Or is he referring to a bit of scripture which has been lost?
Qumran, that's obviously.
No. Another one, another wonderful conundrum, which I don't have the facts at my fingertips. But of course, the interesting thing is he says it's in Jeremiah, and in Zechariah. Yeah. But he got past that problem. I have a person in the congregation who found this thing, you know, Jeremiah says about 30 pieces of silver. And he thought, oh, I want to find that. So he read through Jeremiah, and he couldn't find it. So then he got an audio Bible and listened to the whole of Jeremiah and couldn't find it. And he was halfway through another version of Jeremiah, you know, another Bible version, when someone said to him, well, actually, it's in Zechariah.
I'm just thinking about, was it Matthew referring to, he should be called a Nazarene? And it's actually, the Old Testament is Nazarite. Now, obviously, that's a bit of poetic license.
That's a problem which is more or less solved. The problem is that he's saying it's a branch. He'll be called a Nazarene, and he obviously wasn't a Nazarene. He'd be called a Nazarite, and he obviously wasn't a Nazarite. He never did shave his head. But if you read Sade and you've got Sade and Zion, which both have a Z sound. And you swap them round, he'll be called the branch, which, of course, in Isaiah, he is called the branch, not Zer. And we assumed it was just a sort of mistake or maybe a bit of play on words because we didn't actually know how to spell Nazareth. We just assumed it was a Zion. And in 1967, they found a signpost for Nazareth. A sort of stone thing, Nazareth 5 miles this way. 7 miles, was it?
and that's a textual variant.
It is like in it's as in branch, and so that it's just the way in which it's written into Greek. You'd think it was Zion, and it wasn't. And Matthew is a little bit more clear than we thought he was.
So branch rather than.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the original.
Yeah, we should have believed the Talmud. You have a couple of references to Nazareth in the Talmud, but it's such a small, itty-bitty place, you know, unimportant. It's just never mentioned anywhere. But there are a couple of places in the Talmud where it's mentioned, and it is spelt that way. But we didn't believe it until we found the signpost. If you wait long enough, someone will dig up the answer.
Back to that dropping tickle. I'm sure that Jesus couldn't have meant it literally if you go on with the next section of the Sermon on the Mount. Teach about anger, teaching about you've heard it said to you, but I say to you. So he wasn't taking a literal version of it, he was going for the spirit of it. And that step really does put it in context, I think.
Yes, except that's when you go through the list of things, you know, you've heard it said, but I say to you, he doesn't correct the Old Testament. He doesn't say, you've seen it in the Old Testament, it says this, but I'm going to tell you something different. But he does refer to the oral traditions of the rabbis, saying, you've heard it said, you know, you should love your neighbour and hate your enemy. Well, that's very similar to what you find in the manual of discipline in the second column, where it says about hating the children of darkness, and God hates the children of darkness, therefore we hate the children of darkness. And it looks like he's saying, you've heard it said this, but I say to you, just love your neighbour. And so he's not correcting the jot and tittle of the Old Testament, he's correcting the oral law which came after.
Yes. Could I ask you, Professor Marshall, the wonderful lecture you gave us showing how saturated with Old Testament words, phrases, ideas, and so on, 1 Peter is. What does that tell us about the recipients of 1 Peter and their culture?
It strongly suggests that these people had the capacity to understand a lot of this, but recently there's been some criticism of this view by an American scholar, Christopher Stanley, who has questioned whether people, ordinary Christians, would have had the capacity to appreciate all these allusions and begin to make a distinction between the deeper meaning that a writer included and the amount you might reasonably expect your hearers or readers to pick up. And wondering if this, well, we've got to make this distinction when doing exegesis of the passage. I'm not sure I altogether agree with him, and I think that we mustn't underrate what early Christians could do, and particularly people in an oral culture who had far better memories for what they heard than we have these days. That would be
But there is some debate about the recipients of 1 Peter as to whether they were diaspora Jews or, in fact,
yes.
Gentiles or
yes.
A mixture.
Yes.
And there are directions within that epistle, in each direction, aren't there? Really?
There are things in 1 Peter which look as if the audience is at least mainly Gentile, I would say. But you can't exclude Jews. The same battle is being fought over Romans. Are the recipients of Romans Gentiles or Jews or both? And equally competent scholars take any of these three positions, because the evidence is so fine.
But in that, it's also worth remembering that though diaspora Jews would have more knowledge of the Old Testament than Gentiles, if they were receiving the apostles' doctrine, to coin a phrase, the Gentiles would have been studying the Old Testament too. They weren't studying the New Testament at that point, and so the scriptures they would have been exposed to would be the Old Testament scriptures. So I think we can assume that the early church, Gentile and Jew, had probably a better knowledge of the Old Testament than your average British church at the moment.
I didn't say that.
Could I ask a question just on that point? Would the Gentile Christians also have been able to get a copy of the Septuagint? Or was it available? Or had they to go to the synagogue to get it? Or?
I think getting hold of a copy of any scroll of anything for most of history has been next to impossible. Until printing arrived, there were very few copies of anything. It would have cost a lifetime's wages to buy the scrolls of the Old Testament because of the amount of work that was involved in copying. So copies would actually have been in synagogues. The only private individuals who could own them are the sort of private individuals who pilot their own jets and own their own helicopters today.
So actually writing a letter like Peter did, he must have had access, did he have access to the synagogue to check that he had actually got the right?
Septuagint was available in synagogues. The Jewish rules about what you can rescue from a burning building on the Sabbath includes foreign scrolls. So, the Septuagint was available. Whether they would welcome Christians to come in and have a look at their scrolls or not, I don't know. But people did make their own copies. You know, you look in the rubbish dump at Oxyrhynchus and you find copies of Plato and of New Testament texts. People just copied their own texts as they wanted to. And it was a popular pastime for women who had nothing better to do.
one can find astonishing things just showing you must make assumptions. Something happened to me a few years ago. I was visiting Cambridge, going into the Parker Library, and seeing this man who was Archbishop of Canterbury kept a scrapbook. Where you and I would put pictures in the scrapbook, he had letters from Luther, Calvin, Melanchthon, the originals. These hands have held them. Never expected anything of that kind to have survived. But the same with some of these things from the ancient world. May yet turn up.
Yeah. Okay. Other question? Okay, John.
One primarily for Eddie about translating the Old Testament. Isn't part of the value of translating Psalms the fact that the church is meant to sing Psalms, and therefore when you give a group a translation in its own language, they actually need, if it's going to have some good scriptural sung worship, it needs to have the Psalms pretty early.
I might follow up to that, but
no. Absolutely. One of the things which gives me the greatest pleasure in the work we do is the way in which we can work with communities who have their own style of music, but have been told that they have to sing "Jesus Wants Me for a Sunbeam" or "And Can It Be," and to help groups develop their own indigenous worship based on the scriptures. Now, there is an awful lot in the New Testament epistles which makes great hymnody, but the Psalms is pretty good too. So it is wonderful to provide both the Psalms and then help folks say, how do we use our music to sing the Psalms?
Just to say it, you shouldn't mention both those two songs in the same sentence.
I do apologise.
I just wanted to ask this as a supplementary. David, you were talking about how the Masoretes preserved the correct pronunciation of the vowels. What's your opinion of Haig Venturian's theory that the redundant punctuation actually preserves the actual cantillation from the...
The punctuation in the Psalms is horrendous. And it's probably because there's two sets of punctuation. You've got a set of punctuation below and a set of punctuation above, or there's a mixture sometimes on... Oh, it's terrible. And I just refuse to have anything to do with it. And the theories as to why you've got that is even worse. So you're suggesting that in the punctuation you got some of the sort of notes of the cancer. I think we just got two sets of punctuation and no one knew which one to use. They just put them both in, and it's like German. It's terrible.
For those of you who don't know, Haig Venturian, I think I pronounced that right, is a French Jewish musicologist who produced a theory that there was specific meaning for each little punctuation symbol, and actually composed the music to go with the Hebrew Psalms, which, I mean, some musicologists and rabbis think makes a lot of sense. But just so people know what we're talking about. Yeah.
Bruce Waltke, the grammarian, the Hebrew grammarian, he's written some wonderful things, not particularly wonderful in the Psalms, but he at a party he was he decided to have this as a music, singing of the Psalms according to this theory, and his wife walked in and said, "What's that horrible noise?"
Another question? Yes?
Just a comment on that singing. Some of the best singing of German chorales, I say my wife is, because I'm not that good at music, and she is, was by Bataks in North Sumatra, who got perfect pitch, and they love singing German chorales. And so those kind of tunes were mingling to them. And you could actually hear them sing, because there were a large Christian community there, along the roadside when you went along. So let's not despise all that stuff.
I don't despise it, but I do object to it being forced upon communities when they have their own music. I listen to a lot of Bach chorales. I like them. If I could just put in a plug, David has passed round a sheet to sign up for his more popular writings. If you Google my name, you'll find my blog, on which I write on Bible translation issues for a popular audience. I'm doing a series on what the church can learn from Steve Jobs at the moment.
One thing where the Jews were putting in corrective, and it seems they might have one is this text from Isaiah which says, "Thou hast increased the nation and not increased the joy." And the rabbis wouldn't believe that the not should be there. There's correction in the margin. But actually, he has increased the Jewish nation and not increased the joy ever since they refused the Messiah.
If I could make a comment on something that David said in his introduction, which was that in different senses the three of us here are Bible translators, can I suggest that all of us are? And that translation as a metaphor for what the church is about and taking the revelation of God through Christ and through his word and making it comprehensible to the world around us is what all of us do. And day by day, as we meet with people, both through our lives and through our words, we are translating what God has communicated to us. I'm in a room full of Bible translators.
Thank you. I mean, in a sense, that in the illustrates the point we're making about the distinction between the jot and tittle thing of the standard Hebrew. At the Reformation, all the reformers believed that there was, you know, a given divine text. But it didn't stop there being a huge variety of interpretations of that text, depending on how they took it. So there's the Lord Jesus was speaking his interpretation in Aramaic, even though they may appeal to the standard Hebrew plan.
Mm-hmm. Just thinking about that, I found a great challenge going into school, primary school, and on Good Friday, and trying to tell those young kids what the death of Christ meant. It was a real challenge to me because I obviously knew the sacrificial system of the Old Testament, I knew all that, but they hadn't got any background at all on that. And it seemed to be a real challenge to interpret what that meaning was to them, about what Jesus, if you said Jesus was sacrificed, well, what's sacrifice? And if you tried other things, ransom and all that, it sort of went over their head. And helping them to, at an early age, to assimilate what Jesus had done on the cross was a real challenge.
Mm-hmm. I suppose in Africa it's probably easier to talk sacrificial language than to...
It can be, but I think the bigger difference in Africa is that there is a more openness to talk about religion or spiritual issues anyway. You can talk about anything on the bus, and you know, I guarantee that it is very unlikely that on my train to High Wycombe this evening I will talk about spiritual issues with anybody. On a bus journey across Ivory Coast, I would share the gospel with three or four people very easily because of the environment. The issue with, that was partly a filler, so I could think. The issue with sacrifices actually becomes rather complex because while there are more sacrifice is more a part of life in much of West Africa, there are multiple understandings of what sacrifice is according to different groups and those who have a stronger animist base, those who have a more Islamic base will look at sacrifices in a different way. And it's very easy to assume that because you're using the same word you mean the same thing, and it may well not be the case.
But Isaiah 53 is so good. I mean, that is the best passage I find for Good Friday. It's even better than the New Testament passages, which is absolutely fantastic that Isaiah 53 should be there to help me and to help other people. It's just one of those incredible passages.
The thing is...
Sorry, do you mind me speaking? That is the problem... is we know that it's precious to me, but some people would say, but the Lord laid on him the iniquity of us all. That's not just. I mean, can you?
I mean, we know it's not just, but yeah.
It's part of the broader question of whether it is moral for one person to bear the punishment due to another, and people keep bringing this forward as an objection to the atonement. I can't see why. If I'm due to pay a fine because I've been speeding or something and I can't pay and somebody else pays it, what's wrong with that?
It's grace.
Yeah.
Any further questions? Do any of you want to just add anything just to wrap things up?
Just to add to my previous point, that it's interesting, in a recent book on substitutionary atonement, the one called Pierced for Our Transgressions, the major witness they call upon to demonstrate the nature of the death of Christ is Isaiah 53, rather than the New Testament.
Well, if there are no further questions, we can move to our AGM. And then people are free to just talk and go home. Or-